This is Microbe Mail, and I'm your host, Vandana Chubavan. So this is part two of our HIV-focused episodes. In our previous episode, we spoke to Dr. Ankita Kadakia of the USA, and she talked us through the diagnosis and management of HIV from the US perspective. So today, on this episode, we'll be looking at exactly the same topic from the South African perspective with the same set of questions for our guest. I'm joined again today by my right-hand virologist and co-host, Ruwan Murray. How are you doing today, Ruwan?
Hi, very well, then. Glad to be here.
Great. And we're really honored to be joined today by Professor Francois Venter as our guest expert, who's joining us today. Hi, Francois. Thanks so much for being with us today on Microbe Mail. Please tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
So hi, everybody. I'm Francois Venter. I pretty much did all my training at WITS since I was a baby doctor. I got dumped at the university and never left. And yeah, pretty much specialized there, did my FCP, got grandfathered into infectious diseases and kind of ended up in HIV by mistake. And more recently, been very focused on the kind of NCD world and the kind of overlap with HIV. Obviously, lots of the opportunistic infections and illnesses and things that went with HIV, but it's been a wild ride. So looking forward to chatting.
That's awesome. And we're really looking forward to listening to all of your pearls and your expertise. So just a couple of reminders to the listeners before we head into this episode. Remember to follow us on your favorite podcast player of choice. You can follow us on social media. We're on X, Instagram, Facebook, and we also now have a TikTok page. All the team members also have LinkedIn profiles, so you can follow us there as well. Remember, if you've got a 5-star rating sitting in your pocket, we'd love to have that. And remember to always share Microbe Mail with colleagues, friends, and anyone who you think might be interested. Okay, are we ready to head into this?
Let's go.
Great. Okay, Francois, first question then to start off this episode is, how do you make the diagnosis of HIV in South Africa? And are two point-of-care tests sufficient for this?
So it's an interesting question. There's a bit of a history behind it too. So the short answer is yes. Two good ELISAs, point-of-care tests, sort of finger prick ones that we all used to, are completely adequate in our setting. Mm-hmm. You know, in the old days, we used to do Western blots and we used to send away for all manner of tests. We actually, a couple of years, probably a good decade ago, actually recommended against Western blots. The private labs were doing them, and it was pretty much a money-making exercise. They used to charge an absolute fortune for them, and we, as a clinician society, made a specific recommendation against them. There are certain situations where you may want to do verifications, and there are complex situations, you know, usually in the seroconversion situation or where you have complicated situations where one test comes back negative and one comes back positive, where you may want to go down this algorithm road. But by and large, two rapids are adequate for making the diagnosis. And, you know, it served us well in South Africa. The tests that we use, the rapids, are verified by the NHLS. They do a really good job. So people can be really confident in the tests. You do need to, you know, just have your spidey sense in the background up. We have so many people who are positive that very, very occasionally people will slip through the system. Mm. It's usually healthcare worker error, to be quite honest. You know, where somebody's slipped up and misread something. We have had people observing healthcare workers reading the tests, and they don't do it properly often. So, you know, if the test says, you know, review after 5 or 8 minutes, whatever the test specs are, people don't do that properly. In fact, when we do self-tests where patients actually do the test themselves, they're much more likely to do it properly. Mm. So, you know, just if you do ever run into a patient where the back of your neck says, listen, this one I might need to review a little bit, do think about that. But by and large, if you're doing the test, if you see the test is in the hands of somebody you trust, those two tests are good enough.
Okay, great. So leading a bit into one of those hair at the back of your neck complex situations, how would you approach a patient with an undetectable viral load and equivocal serological testing that you might come across in the wards or be called about?
So this is where I phone a friend, including people like Ruan, and where you do start, you do see the antibodies waning, and you do need to be quite careful in those situations. My first port of call is generally doing a formal ELISA and sending it off to the lab to make sure that they, and that generally is almost always positive, and that that'll tell you either way. If it comes back negative, you're into the realm of weirdness that needs you to start phoning a friend. It generally does mean the person's is going to end up being negative, but there are situations where you need to start doing separate tests. We start looking at things like qualitative viral loads, but it really does need you to go and sit down and look at the full clinical history, where that person came from, who made the diagnosis, and how they came to be there. So you really are into the realm of infectious diseases specialization, and that's where you need to involve lots of people. That's the lab people are absolutely critical in that. That's where I end up for you guys and saying, come help. And you'll often find that that's where, as I said, it's usually healthcare worker error rather than lab error that's starting to declare itself. I've had tragic cases of patients who are never positive, actually are documented negative and were put onto antiretrovirals for over a decade sometimes by very famous professors, just by mistake. It was just medical error. So you get that sort of extreme. You also get extremes where people had, in the older days, some of the older tests came back positive in, with rheumatological conditions, with malaria, with things like that, pregnancy even. So you need, as I said, you just need to keep your spidey sense up and go back to those cases, sit with the lab people and send many tests, and then you're going to work with that patient very carefully because they're often devastated. They made peace with their diagnosis, and it's a hard thing. I think you need to also understand these patients are few and far between. In my career, there's probably been 10 that I've had to deal with, and they're all referred in. So you're going to find them, but they're few and far between. And like I said, you need a team to help you. Do not do this alone. It's got legal consequences, it's got ethical consequences, it's and they're hard. Work with all your friends and work with the patient very carefully. You need a lot of empathy and sympathy for what's gone down here with everyone concerned.
Okay.
Thanks, Francois. So just, we've got a couple of students listening and general clinicians and junior clinicians. So when you say phone a friend and you're talking about this team, I assume you mean specialist virologist would be one of those team members, an infectious diseases specialist would be another. Is there anyone else who you think should be involved in this scenario?
Yeah, I think, sensible people like you would trust from, you often have links to your medical school of people you trust. Those two people, I think, are absolutely critical.
Right.
Draw them in. You may want to get, just from a general physician, just some idea. The clinician society has always got resources, and
Right.
their testing guidelines are always very, very useful just to go
Yeah.
and refer to. And they often will update things. It's always good just to check in with them because they often will have their ears to the ground in case there's been a dodgy testing batch or something going on. And I think those kind of things are always useful just to have in the background. There are also situations where patients come out of clinical trials, especially these acute seroconversion trials, where very early treatment messes with the serology somewhat. So you also just need to be wired into the debates about how to make these diagnoses. And these weird and wonderful cure studies that are starting to crop up again, if you end up with one of those patients in your hands, you just need to be linked very quickly to the people doing research in that environment. And lots of South Africans are in the thick of it. So, in this day and age, you can be linked to international experts within 10 minutes, and all the South African experts are only too happy to help.
Absolutely. So the HIV Clinician Society information is very useful. So we'll make sure we put a link to the site in the show notes of this episode. So if you're listening, you can contact them through there.
Just for everyone to know, it's like I sit on these adjudication committees where, on these clinical trials where we get the most bizarre serology coming to us on these patients, these prevention studies. And we sometimes sit there, like 10 of us, the so-called international experts, scratching our heads, just wait. And sometimes we just sit there and say, bring the patient back in 3 weeks and we'll repeat everything and see what's happening. So just to let people know, some of this stuff is just bloody hard. So, involve people. Just don't suffer in silence. You don't need to solve this by yourself. You need to, you're talking about a handful of patients, but they're really hard. So, call everyone in.
Absolutely.
Yep. And Dana, from a totally very esoteric topic that I just found really interesting was funny viral load results. I read a case report on CAR T cell therapy resulting in a detectable viral load, because the CAR T cells, basically it's modified T cells to target usually cancer, but they use a retroviral, a lentiviral vector to get the right genes into that cell. And then you can have viral loads picking up that essential cancer therapy. So, I mean, completely, it's very unlikely that you'll ever come across it, but I do think it's really quite interesting.
You can smell clinician fear over the television screen right now, Ron. So, yes, I understood our thoughts. But yes, that's exactly the kind of thing. If people are doing weird and wonderful research or new therapeutics and things, I think you can anticipate that some of these tests are going to come back in a way that is difficult for us to interpret. So get the experts involved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, very true. So then, Francois, let's go back to the straightforward patient again and assume that our patient now tests negative. Who do you offer PrEP to, and what regimen is generally used in South Africa?
So PrEP is, just for everyone, PrEP is the one area of HIV that's evolving incredibly rapidly. We'll get to treatment, I'm sure, but treatment at the moment is going to stay the same for the next couple of years, so everyone can take a deep breath there. But I'm afraid PrEP is moving like wildfire, and in fact is a bit of a revolution. So HIV prevention, after being stuck in the mud for 30 years, is suddenly moving really quickly. The current therapeutic is a combination of two drugs, both of which everyone is very familiar with, which is tenofovir and emtricitabine or lamivudine. It doesn't really matter. They're both interchangeable. But it's highly, highly effective if you take it. You take it once a day. There is a lead-in period for women. For men, you can pretty much start it quite quickly. There's almost what we call on-demand PrEP. It's starting to look more and more like emergency contraception, or you have to have if you're going into a high-risk situation, you can actually take it just before entering that high-risk situation. So the kind of combinations that we use is that combination, tenofovir, 3DC, or FTC. And I think your audience will be very, very familiar. It's the combination, the two drugs that are a combination of treatments. We just add dolutegravir to that in first line. It's incredibly safe. It's very well tolerated. There's a little bit of gastrointestinal side effects for the average patient occasionally. But by and large, you swallow a tablet a day, and the efficacy, as long as you're very adherent, starts approaching 100%. Adherence, though, is an issue. And as I'm sure all of you are students of human nature, it's really hard to get people to take these tablets every day, and particularly for PrEP, much more so than for treatment, interestingly. So the biggest issue with PrEP is actually the adherence conversations. You'll hear tons about bone and kidneys and side effects and blah, 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 blah. But actually the biggest issue here is to actually get people to take the tablets. So that combination orally is very, very effective and very useful. And like I said, if you take them every day, you start getting close to 100%. In real world, very few people get to that 100%, and therefore the efficacy starts dropping quite dramatically. So I'd say the battle is adherence, but it's the same as treatment. The battle is adherence.
Great. So, I guess one way to improve adherence is to increase the timing between doses and have fewer doses required. And that kind of leads into the next question, and what's on the horizon for injectable PrEP, especially in South Africa?
So firstly, there is some evidence that we could maybe decrease the number of doses for oral PrEP, but it's a nightmare. It's hard enough taking it daily to say, we'll just take it on weekdays or 4 days a week. My personal view is just, with oral PrEP, is make it as simple as possible and take it at one time of the day. I think these alternatives, but you're right, the big move now is into long-acting PrEP. It's not just injectable PrEP. They've got these tablets that you can take once a week. There actually was a a monthly tablet that was being tested. Unfortunately, it caused lymphopenia, but you know, it would be amazing. You sort of take it on payday, I guess. You know, once a month would have been amazing. It looked amazing, except for the fact that it crashed your lymphocytes, and
yeah,
in some cases, it didn't come back for months and years afterwards. It's the tablet's been tested as a weekly tablet, and its toxicity doesn't seem to be manifesting at all, which is very hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
And for treatment, though, not for prevention, sadly. There's another variant on the drug which is being tested for prevention, and hopefully will make its way through things. But the big news is the injectables. There are several of them, and in fact, there are dozens. All the drug companies are trying out. The one that's registered in this country, unfortunately not readily available yet, is a drug called cabotegravir. It's an integrase inhibitor, so similar to dolutegravir, but with a lower resistance barrier. You can use it for treatments in combination. Again, registered in this country, just not readily available, hellishly expensive. We combine it with rilpivirine, which I'm sure many of your people in the audience will remember. It's an oldish NNRTI. We use it for patients who have suppressed viremia and you have no evidence of previous resistance. You can switch them across this combination for treatment. But cabotegravir is very, very effective as a prevention modality. You can give it every 2 months. It's more effective than oral therapy, probably because you've solved the adherence problem. You know, you don't have to remember to take oral tablets every day. And the problem with cabotegravir is access, firstly, because it's the drug company isn't making enough. And it's sort of drip feeding it into countries, even rich countries are battling to get access to it. The other problem is you actually have to be quite skilled at administering the injection. You know, this is not into a primary healthcare clinic and the nurse just jabs you. You actually have to inject it at a certain angle in a different place. And it's, yeah, like you need a certain amount of training. You need to be doing it quite often to sort of have the training in mind. You also need a special needle if you're over a certain BMI. So it's all in all a bit of a pain in the neck at the moment. You need specialist injection sites, essentially. Our unit's been doing it for a while. We have one doctor who does it, and it certainly isn't me. I wouldn't go anywhere near it because I don't have the skills to give that injection. So that's the one that everyone's excited about, but no one has access to. There's a handful of patients that are on it in the country at the moment, and we're hoping that'll scale up. In fact, this week, there's a whole lot of drug being delivered across the country. So a couple of thousand South Africans will go onto it, but you know, we need millions of them on it to really make a meaningful difference to new infection rates. But it's an exciting drug. It's well-tolerated. It solves your prevention issues. As long as people are willing to come in and get injected every 2 months, it's pretty good. It's a bit like, I guess, contraception for HIV in many ways. There's a new one that's being tested. It's made by Gilead, which is a subcutaneous injection. It's called lenacapavir. It works by a completely different mechanism, but the nice thing about this one is it's subcutaneous and you give it every 6 months. And the preliminary data, it's still being tested and we're waiting for the prevention data. It should be out, I think, this year, actually. But if it works, it's going to be a complete game changer. You can imagine coming in for a subcut injection 6 months. And in this case, the patients probably could self-administer the injection. We have no idea about cost. The stuff we've done suggests it's much cheaper to make than cabotegravir, which is a bit of a nightmare. You need all sorts of fancy machinery. So this would be something big. And again, the preliminary data for safety suggests it's very, very good. It's already licensed, interestingly enough, for treatment for highly treatment-experienced patients. I don't think it's licensed. I'm not aware of it being licensed in this country. We don't really have many patients that really would qualify anyway. So it would probably only be needed for a tiny, tiny number of, you know, probably counted on two hands in this country, you know. So watch the space. And then there's a whole range of other new injectables that are coming. These guys are in the nano formulation space, are making huge changes to all manner of drugs, not just the ARVs, not even just to anti-infectives, to all sorts of other drugs as well, where they're doing all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff, including Prof. Chinara's group at Wits. where they're changing the formulation so that they're putting them in patches and all sorts of microneedles and, you know, spraying them and doing all sorts of funny stuff to them to, you know, just make them last longer and longer. So, you know, the days of a single tablet for all chronic medication is probably hopefully going to be a thing of the past for our patients going forward. So things like ARVs are only one area where they're fiddling with this stuff, seeing that they're doing it for hep C, they're doing it for TB drugs. So, you know, in the future, you know, people are going to pop in and out for a range of injections and patches and things rather than, you know, for a tub of tablets. So it's a very exciting field over the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Rowan, I think we've covered question four here.
Yeah, no, I think so. It seems that subcutaneous injections are becoming quite popular with lenacapavir on the horizon, and Ozempic, you know, having its moment in the sun.
Yeah. It's interesting because that is one of the tablets that, you know, Ozempic is a very good example. So semaglutide, Ozempic, the original formulation from Novo was liraglutide. I think it's called Saxenda in South Africa. And that was a daily injection, and it's a polypeptide that it took them ages, took Novo a long time to move to semaglutide, to the weekly injection. And that was continually trying to get around the fact that, you know, that they needed to increase the half-life of the drug. And that's how they got to semaglutide. It took them a good decade of synthesis to get to the point where they could get the GLP-1 to take that long to for the breakdown. Semaglutide is also made as an oral tablet, and it took them ages to get that right as well. It's very hard because, you know, as peptides get broken down in the stomach. But it's a fascinating history to see how the GLP-1s evolved. And now suddenly, obviously, it's an explosion. I think there are 20 or 30 of them, not just GLP-1s, but all those hormonal analogs for appetite suppression are being explored in various forms, and are sort of making their way onto the market en masse, you know, for everything from heart failure and fatty liver and kidney disease and goodness knows what. But the synthetic revolution is really phenomenal. It's going to benefit infectious diseases, you know, no end, once we've got drugs that we can use as depot preparations. I mean, TB alone, I think, is going to be so much better served. You know, these poor patients who, you know, in poor social circumstances, having to come in for DOTS programs once a day is going to seem like the dark ages, I think, in the future, when we have depot preparations that we can use on people with XDR TB and who can, you know, hopefully not have to be inconvenienced the way we do at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very, very, it's fascinating, actually, to see that.
Yeah.
So, Francois, let's move a little bit away from PrEP now and talk about PEP. So let's assume you now have this patient who tests negative, but had a non-occupational exposure, let's say about 12 hours ago. How would you approach post-exposure prophylaxis in this patient for HIV specifically? And are there any other pathogens you should be considering?
So again, I think this is an interesting, it's very weird. This is how I got into HIV is, you know, when I first finished my specialist degree, I joined an HIV clinical trials unit. Oh, it's actually an infectious diseases clinical trials unit. I was doing research on pneumococcus and cryptococcus and a few other pathogens, but also HIV, then new drugs. We had things like D4T or all things. But I was asked to give lectures on PEP. No one was interested in PEP. And I very quickly became a PEP expert in the country because nobody else wanted to do it. So I got all these calls about PEP. And developed these approaches to PEP, which allowed me, and I had to review the literature, and it's allowed me to stay up to date. And I can tell you that, for all of you, that you can become a PEP expert very, very quickly. And again, the Clinician Society guidelines were way ahead of their time, because they were the first people to say, stop differentiating between occupational and non-occupational PEP, because it was just silly. You know, the principles were exactly the same.
Yeah.
Also, you know, they were also the first people to point out, you know, if you're a sex worker, is that occupational, non-occupational PEP, you know, like quite realistically. And if you're a paramed and you like suddenly out in the field and you suddenly run into like trauma at the side of the road and you're off duty, what is that? You know, and a whole range of situations, like if you're a boxer and you're exposed to blood, what is that? And it was just useful because it frames the exposure in a way that is more useful as a clinician and for the people having to deal with exposure. And that was my experience, was the exposures were never clean. They were not, I pricked myself with a 16 gauge needle 2.7 hours ago, and the source patient was X. It was always like, I woke up this morning and there was a, you know, I there was a colt in my slipper that slipped in while I was while I was operating yesterday, and I have no idea what the serious status of the patient was. Should I take PEP? And I was like, I have no idea. It's like, those were the kind of cases that I would see, or it would be the most bizarre exposures from the northern suburbs, some of which were so cringeworthy that like I'd be like, what in God's name is happening in these communities? You really would be exposed to the most unbelievable stuff. And then also I'd get, people who were in tears and absolute anxiety wrecks that would be exposed to the most unbelievably low risk stuff that, would be beside themselves. So I got into this mode of actually treating the anxiety first and then moving into obviously the actual risk. And like you say, these other pathogens they need to be scared of, hepatitis B, they would not even be thinking about. And that's so the starting point, and that's where the Clinician Society guidelines are really worth reading. They're nice and practical. They take you through a nice stepwise approach and what to do, which things to worry about, looking at who you're talking to. So if you're talking to a young medical student, asking, have you been vaccinated against hepatitis B is a really good starting point, because if they have been, there's no problem. If they haven't been, you can start there. Asking about like the nature of the exposure. If they got splashed in the eye, how bad is the anxiety? The one thing that is useful is to understand, 15 years ago, we used a lot of AZT for PrEP, and it was very toxic. And there you're weighing up a very toxic drug against a very low risk of exposure. And now we're using TLD essentially as post-exposure prophylaxis. Post-exposure prophylaxis. And it's a much, much safer drug. So there I have a much lower threshold for dishing the drug out. So if somebody's incredibly has splashed themselves in the eye, the risk of transmission is unbelievably low. They're probably far more likely to be struck by lightning on their way home in Joburg, or whatever the Cape Tonian or Durban equivalent is. But, probably being washed away in a flood at this stage.
Sure, having a car accident in South Africa is probably higher.
Your chance of a car accident anywhere in South Africa is far, far, far higher than that risk of transmission. But the problem is that people, they're not necessarily rational, and their levels of anxiety is incredibly high. And I can relate to that. I've had exposures, and like I'm the so-called expert, and I still can feel my blood pressure going through the roof. So I think it's worth being quite empathic. It's one thing to be a professor of medicine and close to godhood. And then, when you're a 23-year-old and 25-year-old in the thick of the wards and the cut and thrust of the intake ward where there's very little support, and you're already stressed out of your bracket and you already have, everything against you, having a splash that is like freaking you out, I just sometimes think it might be kinder to simply give them the drug and let them like feel a bit safe for the month. I really don't think that's a problem. I think you need to just be a little bit empathic and sympathetic and just weigh all of that up. TLD is so safe. And a young person with normal kidneys, just weigh it up and think about that. I'm not saying dish it out like Smarties. You need to understand that all drugs have side effects, but I also think that it's worth assessing those exposures. On the other end of the spectrum, you get the cowboys who actually do prick themselves and are like, I think it's absolutely fine. I don't need this drug. In those cases, I do need, think it's worth saying is like, listen, dude, I think you should reassess and take this, even if it's, I can't quantify the risk for you. I think this is the one time I would actually swallow the tablets for the full month, and take them. So I think there's a little bit of art to all of this that is needed, and there's a gray zone in all of it. I've only seen two transmissions in my entire career, and they were both in people who didn't take PEP. And they were one was a nurse who was citing a cannula, and one was in a young a doctor who was doing a FNA, and both didn't take PEP in time. So, in a very long career of Pep, it's a really rare occurrence. I'm fairly certain that there are lots of cases I haven't seen, but it's rare.
Okay.
But TLD,
TLD.
within 72 hours, the short answer, take it for 28 days and you're going to be fine.
Fantastic. So changing gears a little bit, in our case that we've been following along, the test does come back positive. So I think the first question would be, in a patient newly diagnosed with HIV with a low CD4 count, presenting with an opportunistic infection, I want to give you a few scenarios, and we've just briefly touch on, what is the most likely pathogen or etiological agent that's going to be causing this situation. So starting out, a patient presents with pneumonia, they're hypoxic, they're bilateral infiltrates. What's going to be your first thought?
So I think we've just finished yet another autopsy study on advanced HIV. And the sad thing is it's still TB, TB, TB. We still see tons of PCP and we still see tons of other funny ho-hos. But, South Africa still sees a ton of TB and a ton of PCP. And we still see crypto and we still see all the usual suspects. So the thing about advanced HIV is, just to take a step up from the epidemiology of HIV, the average CD4 count at ARV initiation in South Africa has been going up since probably about 2010. So we're probably into the early 400s. So patients are actually generally starting their ARVs at a very good CD4 count. There's very little going on at 400 in most people. If there's a little bit going on, some skin stuff, very occasionally they'll come in with something serious. The problem is, there's a substantial number of patients who are still coming in very late, and it's probably in the order of somewhere between 10 and 20% with what you're describing. And that number hasn't budged much for the almost since we started the ARV program. And the interesting thing is that hasn't budged much in anywhere in the world. It hasn't budged much in Washington, in London, in India, in South Africa. So, this problem with advanced HIV disease is a disaster. Graham Menchie was telling me that still accounts for about 70% of the admissions in Cape Town. Jeremy Nell was saying something similar for here in Joburg. For the hospitalists amongst you are still seeing a ton of these advanced patients, these sick patients with infiltrates all over their lungs. And within that, there's a huge burden of TB, there's a huge burden of pneumococcus, PCP, crypto. And it's a nightmare still to deal with them. And you're going to remain experts on all of this. And one of the problems with the autopsy studies that we've done, I call it TB plus, is that they come in with TB, but they often have a second complicated pathology. They'll often have disseminated crypto, they'll have adeno, they'll have something horrible else happen, they'll have esophageal carcinoma complicating the picture, and one of the biggest challenges to the HIV program is to work out why these people are coming in so late. Why did they dodge the system for so long that they came in with this terrible presentation? And they are hard. Some of our autopsy studies we did at the Gen at Charlotte, and we've got all the smart professors and all the CAT scans and MRIs we could possibly, not all of them. We've got you guys in micro with all the backup, and we still probably half the time didn't make the correct diagnosis of the second pathology. So it's really hard, these advanced patients. TB, we often just hoist some TB therapy at them. We'll throw some broad spectrum antibiotics. If we're smart, we'll put them on PCP therapy. We'll often make the crypto diagnosis because you guys have put in great guidelines for screening. Still, we're missing a substantial amount of background pathology, and it's hard, and we're gonna need to put our heads together to think about what to do more broadly as a strategy. So the case you're describing, sorry, just to cut a very long story short, is still, unfortunately, after 20 years of an ARV program, distressingly very, very common in South Africa and across the world.
All right. So you touched a bit on crypto and TB in general, but any other pathogens that we should, keep our eye out for a patient presenting with chronic meningitis?
So, yeah, TV and crypto are the major ones I would go down the road of. Beyond that, always just, speak to a friendly micro because, we too often don't do the proper stuff. You guys can do this in your lectures, but I do get frustrated sometimes when I see stuff I was always taught to, which is take adequate amount for culture, send for the right cohorts and things like that. Just make sure that you involve people and you look very critically at the patterns and get a good clinical history. That's often not possible, particularly in the meningitis patients, to make sure that you're not dismissing stuff very quickly. When we have looked at the, at the TB, at the meningitis patients, it really has fallen very firmly down in those two organisms. And pneumococcus is the other, which is not a chronic presentation. They're often absolutely catastrophic when they present. But when it comes to chronic meningitis, then you really are into the realm of, partially treated and into a whole range of organisms. As I said, you guys then need to get involved right from the get-go. One of the best things we ever did was have microbiologists on our ward rounds because they immediately would start, poking around and asking the hard questions about, why we didn't do X and why we didn't have Y. Also, I had a very good, especially on the junior doctors, with the infectious disease consultants, it's not difficult to convince them, but just getting better behaviors around what we send and how we send it, particularly when we do lumbar punctures.
Okay, so the other one, a neurological presentation I want to touch on is focal neurological signs, and I think that's an important one to ask about because you might not have access to a scan quickly. So how and you and then you know can't necessarily do an LP. How would what would you think of in such a patient?
So I think, people here was the one area where I think people actually overdiagnosed TB a little bit. And there was a very useful study done a couple of years ago now in KwaZulu-Natal where, they did CAT scans and they saw space-occupying lesions in patients. And the commonest diagnosis, interestingly enough, was non-specific. They biopsied them. But the second most common was toxo. So people do need to understand that, and you'll see the constellation very well. The patient will have thrush in their mouth and they'll look like a wasted patient, but have a very high threshold for implementing toxotherapy. And it's so effective. So one neurological condition that's with space-occupying lesions where I've seen almost complete resolution of the symptoms, and it's astonishing sometimes. Cryptococcomas are extremely rare in HIV, even as an iris phenomenon. I've seen them, but they're very, very rare. TB is a space-occupying lesions, obviously, is on your differential. PML is horrendous, and just, there have been cases that have survived, but it's unusual. Lymphomas and things like that, just also patients do incredibly badly. But toxo is the one thing that you can do something about. So implementing, if you don't have a CAT scan, you're not comfortable about doing a lumbar puncture, you can implement therapy. But you need to be, one of the things I do worry about sometimes about faffing around waiting for a CAT scan is that, I don't think I've ever seen somebody die because of coning. I've seen lots of patients die waiting for a CAT scan. So sometimes I think just doing a lumbar puncture, and if you're stuck out in the rurals, which is, I've worked there a lot, sometimes I think just getting a lumbar puncture and making a diagnosis of cryptomeningitis is probably going to save somebody's life by getting them appropriate therapy rather than faffing around waiting for a CAT scan and putting them in the ambulance and getting them across town and often having that CAT scan refused and the patient dying en route. Rather make a diagnosis and get them onto appropriate therapy than faff around, thinking about, quite a small risk of coning. But you have to be comfortable with all of that, and I certainly did become far more comfortable as I got more experienced. But yeah, toxo starts shooting to the front of the queue when you start looking at focal neurology. TB is your next most common, and then you start looking at PML, lymphomas, and all the others.
Okay. And then just lastly, disseminated skin lesions. I think that's one we have to talk about when we talk about advanced HIVs. What are we thinking when we have a patient presenting with, you know, disseminated skin lesions.
Have a very friendly derm on the end of the phone, and have a very low threshold for doing punch biopsies. Mm. I grieve at the fact that I can't find punch biopsies in the wards like I used to. I used to just biopsy everything. Honestly, it's the simplest procedure. Mm. I mean, it's harder to take blood than it is to do a punch biopsy. And you get tissue, you know, and I hate saying this because I sound so old, the old days. We used to get biopsy results in 3 days from the derms, and they loved doing the path. You know, I think it's just because for some reason, you know, it just came around so quickly.
Mm.
And it was often like nothing I thought it was. You know, sure, make a diagnosis of proposes. I think most of us are relatively competent, or maybe less so now because we see it so little of it now. But, you know, to even the derms had difficulty, although I must say they're just so much better at the clinical diagnosis. They, honestly, the derms were right next door to us. They just wander across, play, like cast eyes and make the most bizarre diagnoses, and they were right half the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've just given up trying to do this stuff. So I really do think, you know, trying to get into a system where you can quickly do a punch biopsy and send it off, you know, just saves you so much hassle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the patient's going to the ward for a couple of days, do it on intake. Just quickly get it out there and just sort of send it out and send it away for culture at the same time that you do for, you know, for path. You send it away in formalin. It's just, you know, I always had the saying that the road to diagnostic happiness is path. And it's, you know, the skin biopsies, if it's not something that's absolutely overt, you're often again get your diagnosis. I've had crypto present in the most bizarre ways and as a skin lesion.
Mm.
You know, when it's obvious crypto skin, it's obvious crypto skin, and you're gonna get it in the blood as a, you know, on the antigen screen anyway. But you can get some stuff that is just, you know, sporotrichosis and all the other stuff that you probably want to hear about.
Mm.
Just get it on the skin. And that's why it's so important to send to micro as well for culture. Just, you know. And now that you've got WhatsApp, you just send it to a friendly derm as a photo at the same time and say, listen, dude, I need help. As I said, I've long given up trying to be a skin specialist. That's just, I've been too wrong too often. You know, beyond the most basic stuff, I just think, I can diagnose molluscum with confidence. I can do crypto, pretty good job with crypto. Proposes, I can pick up with no problem. But beyond the obvious stuff, man, I've been tripped up too often.
It's true. I mean, I think we've even seen patients on ward rounds where you're almost 100% sure this must be histoplasmosis. And when you get the culture back, as you say, it turns out to be a sporotrichosis or something that you weren't expecting. So you're absolutely right.
You know, honestly, like you give some local, you do the punch biopsy, it's done. It's one of the easiest procedures of all. I just wish we had them more readily available. When I was working in the HIV clinic, I used to do them so quickly. It was, if you just got the formalin, it was more about the reagents and the stuff around you. But I used to just run around the wards, and whenever I found some formalin, I'd just palm it and take it down to the clinic and make sure there was a steady supply. But it was wonderful, you know. So have the system in place just to, you know, just to be there. So I think particularly in an intake ward where, you know, things are busy, if you've got the system set up, it really, as I said, it's actually quicker than taking blood. This is bang, bang, done. The patient's sick, they definitely be in the ward for longer than 3 days. And then, you know, you look like an absolute diagnostic king or queen because you've like made this diagnosis of some bizarre fungal infection that everyone else is still pouring over the CAT scan with this bizarre sign. You're like, hey, I know what this is. No, there's a life hack to the most brilliant clinician on the planet. You and your friendly microbiologist.
Brilliant. Thanks for the punch. So just one last quick reminder for the listeners. Put that sample in formalin for the histopathologist, but the microbiologist does not want any formalin. So make sure you take two separate samples. And the microbiology specimen should be slightly moistened with a little bit of normal saline. If you give it to us in formalin, you're killing the pathogens.
You're going to get a howl of outrage away from the micro lab.
François, you mentioned quite a few really important studies. So you can send us those references and we'll make sure we add those into the show notes as well. Listeners, remember to give us your feedback by email or on social media. And also don't forget to add that 5-star rating if you haven't yet. So that's it from us, your micro messengers. That's Vin, Ruwan, Vinitha, Nonx, Esther, and Fatima. We'll see you again soon with more Contagious Mev.